Steve Arino's Italian Eatery is your go-to spot for delicious eats and good vibes. Offering mouth-watering pizzas with all your favorite toppings, pasta dishes that'll make your taste buds dance, killer burgers, and amazing steaks too. Whether you're grabbing a quick bite with friends or enjoying a laid-back dinner with family, Steve Arino's has got you covered. So head over to Chattanooga's North Shore where you can kick back, relax, and let Steve Arino's take care of the cooking. Steve Arino's Italian Eatery is a proud supporter of CADIS.
The Flying Locksmith is your trusted partner in all things security, offering commercial security systems, security cameras, audio and video intercom systems, supply, installation, and commercial-grade door hardware. In need of hands-free hardware to reduce the spread of germs? Worry no more, because the Flying Locksmiths are here to save the day. With fast response times and top-notch service, they'll be sure to keep you safe, secure, and protected in no time. Unlocking peace of mind, one lock at a time. Flying Locksmiths is a proud supporter of alcohol and drug abuse recovery at CADIS.
Welcome to Scarred But Smarter podcast, hosted by Jeff Stiles, presented by CADIS, Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Services, sharing relatable stories of addiction recovery along with our hearts, our voices, and an abundant amount of love with all of those affected by the disease of addiction. We thank you for allowing us to be a part of your journey. And now, here is your host, Jeff Stiles.
Hey folks, and welcome to the inaugural episode, the launch, the debut of a new podcast that is sponsored by CADIS and is called Scarred But Smarter. Scarred But Smarter. And I resemble that remark. My name is Jeff Stiles, and I will be hosting this podcast as often as I am physically able to. And it's going to be basically a roundtable discussion about all things that have to do with recovery. People who have been and are alcoholics and addicts. We can deal with the definitions at some point too later on down the road. I will never be anything but an addict and an alcoholic. I can be in active recovery though and not be using, and that's kind of where I am right now, and hopefully that is where I'll stay. We have a guest in here, and his name is Steven. And Steven, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Jeff.
Very glad to have you, sir. And our first guest, you didn't know you were going to be actually, you know, de-virginizing this whole thing.
I did not, but it is a privilege, and I'm happy to be here. I appreciate it.
And we'll get to Steven and kind of his story here in just a little bit. Also, want to introduce the young lady who has, she lit the fuse on this thing, and she got the folks at CADIS to sign on to it, and it's a brilliant idea. I think that there's really a good niche, as we say these days, out there for this kind of podcast, Mary Catherine Gentry. Now, I can use your whole name, right?
You sure can, yes, absolutely.
No problem there. We just made an instantaneous decision. Yeah. We're flying by the seat of our pants. My personal motto is that planning is for dullards. I'm probably the only one in the room here that actually lives that way, but you're going to actually see this thing, this plane is going to be constructed in the air. So we're going to just kind of cobble it together, but you came up with the idea. Take just a second before we get to Steven and his story and just tell me where it came from, what you're hoping to achieve.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to you, Jeff Stiles, because I speak on behalf of everyone at CADIS when I say you are a huge part of this.
And
we're so grateful. Well, for the most part.
I was going to say there had to be some naysayers somewhere. I'd be
right.
Disappointed.
We're thrilled that you're doing this for us.
Good.
And I'm very grateful. Thank you. So I'm director of development at CADIS, and I plan events, raise money, and I'm always trying to think of creative ways to do just that. So I thought of the podcast, and when I thought of it, I thought of Jeff Stiles, of course, and thought, if he'll do it, I'll do it. So he said yes, and that's what we're doing. So we're going to share, you know, over the course of time, some real life stories on recovery, and hope that it will leave an impact in some of your lives.
CADIS stands for Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Services, and it has been here in this neck of the woods for how long now?
Since 1964, we're celebrating our 60th anniversary this year.
Just 4 years younger than me.
Oh, my.
Wow.
Yes.
And hopefully it's not wearing on them the way it is on me. I've lived some dog years. I imagine Cadis has too. And a special thanks to Sean Whitfield and Whitfield Media Group for letting us use their immaculate and super cool studio here as well. Now, we do have some underwriters, some sponsors of the show. You'll be hearing from them as we go on. But let me go ahead and just get started with Stephen here. Stephen, and I know him. For all transparency's sake, Stephen and I know each other from 12-step programs here in town. There's a meeting down at St. Paul's every day at noon, and that's usually where I see him. And we'd already kind of become buddies. I didn't realize that you were going to be my first guest or a guest at all up until just recently. I don't know that much about your life story. Actually, are you a homeboy? Are you from this area?
I am not. I'm originally from Eastern North Carolina. So Fayetteville, I was born and raised.
That's a crazy town.
It is. We call it Vietnam.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can guess why.
Yeah, absolutely.
I moved to Tennessee in 2017. I lived in Cleveland first. I guess I won't get into my story immediately, but rehab, Cadis brought me to Chattanooga in 2021.
So you came here specifically for the facilities that Cadis represent?
Yes. I did not know it was accessible. I thought rehab was for rich people. I guess.
It can be.
Yeah,
it can
be
if they decide to go down. I think we were discussing some of those places just a little bit ago before we got started. Some of them you can actually roll some serious bank into.
I've heard as much. But Cadis, I came down here in December of 2021 to go to Cadis, and I've been here ever since.
Let me ask the first real personal question. Could you have done it without rehab? Because I have my sponsor. He's one of those kind of naysayers. He goes, man, I'm not going to pay somebody $10,000 just to ride in a van and figure out where all the meetings are. But I don't think he had the problem that I did. I mean, I had to have physical medical assistance to detox. I think I would have died, and I definitely don't think I'd have made it without rehab.
If you're anything like me, if you didn't die, you would have wanted to.
Yeah.
I absolutely could not have done it without rehab because I had to have medically assisted treatment as well. I did opiates and alcohol primarily. So, you know, that was my biggest fear and the reason that I couldn't get out of it on my own. I tried several methods, obtaining, you know, Suboxone and things like that on the street, trying to get off myself, never could do it. So it was imperative that I get to rehab. And
so 1A, you tried on your own, didn't
yes.
work.
No.
All right, you can take notes as you see fit out there. We have not had that many meetings of the minds. Even figuring out exactly who are we targeting here? Are we targeting somebody who's struggling? Are we targeting you know, people who are in recovery and have a few 24, you know, hour periods in their belt? And I've decided we're just going to hit all of them. Anybody who's listening hopefully will find something of use in this podcast. And that was part of it, was the necessity for you and the necessity for me for having that to have some help, a helping hand, somebody not just to show us where the meetings are, but to give us what the basic steps were in the very, very beginning. And of course, there are 12 steps in the AA program. Cadis is an AA-based program, just so you folks will know. What was the most difficult part for you? And we're going to get to your very intriguing job. And if you talk about a job that screams, give me a drink. Stephen had it, and we're going to get to that in a second, so you'll know one of the reasons we have him in here. But what was it that made you pull the trigger on, you know what, I've got to change my life?
Pure desperation. It's pretty much that simple. I was on the verge, without being too specific, you know, I was essentially paying my rent, and that was it. I mean, it was so bad, I would, you know, at the worst, I'd say I was probably living off a bowl of cereal a day. You know, every single spare dollar that I had went to drugs and booze.
Folks, I can assure you that these are not exaggerations you hear in here.
They are absolutely not, no. And I had overdosed.
Hey, you were eating.
At
least you were eating.
Barely.
Go ahead now, please.
I'm already a skinny guy, and it got to where I was gaunt, for sure. But
POW looking.
Yes, yes. But, it was just pure desperation.
Tell me about the overdose.
So the first one, it was definitely an overdose. It wasn't enough, I guess, to get me. Well, neither of them were enough to get me to, you know, stop. But the first one wasn't as bad as the second. The people that were there, I would say friends, but probably, you know how that goes. Mm. They were able to kind of, you know, smack me around and bring me back. The second one, I woke up on the floor with two paramedics and two officers standing above me.
Was that mostly the opiates? At that
oh yeah,
point?
Absolutely. Okay. It was fentanyl. Yeah.
So you actually used it on purpose?
Oh, yeah.
You know what? I haven't met that many people who actually have admitted using it on purpose. I thought I knew everything about the world of drugs. Up until just a few years ago, I didn't even know what that word meant. I didn't know what it was. And I mean, and I had an issue with pain pills myself, oxycodone, hydrocodone. I had bad back problems. I'm a tall guy. And using them as prescribed, I'm not trying to slam any medical doctors or clinics around here, but using them as prescribed, I became addicted. But I just thought fentanyl, what I was hearing originally, was it's something that was slipping into the market. It was coming around the corner and it was ending up in your cocaine. It was ended up in a fake pill that you thought was an actual pharmaceutical pill. I didn't even realize until just a couple of years ago they actually made fentanyl as a painkiller to be prescribed to people. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, for primarily probably for end of life type stuff to keep you. Yeah, I'm not a doctor.
So that's where OxyContin started.
Yeah, but I started with pain pills when I was about 20 years old, so 14 years ago. I started that way, and it was, you know, it got out of hand for sure, because I was drinking that entire time too, and you know how that mix goes. I was able to get off of the opiates here and there because I hadn't, you know, graduated to heroin or anything yet. And I never was an IV user, but I was, you know, smoking it and snorting it. But you're right, it did start getting laced. It was fentanyl was being, you know, laced into everything. And but no, it got to the point. What happened is in 2019, when I came back from the job you were mentioning, it was just someone that I had worked with in Cleveland. He had been doing it while I was gone, and he just one day on the way home, he's like, "Do you want to hit this?" And I did, and it was off to the races. I mean, it was quick, and it took me low quick.
So you had a taste for the high you would get from an opiate to begin with,
yeah,
or the low, or the, you know, euphoria, whatever it was that you were getting, and this kicked it into overdrive. You are, this is for me.
Absolutely. And they, you know, I've read here and there that it happens so quick. Like if you use fentanyl for a day or two or three, maybe, I mean, you're going to have withdrawals that quick. So it's just like you got to have it immediately. That's exactly what happened to me, for sure.
Are you looking to bring your commercial project to life? Look no further, because the expert team of Robert Roberts General Contractors specializes in turning your vision into a reality. From concept to completion, Robert Roberts General Contractors handles every detail of your commercial project with precision and care, ensuring that your project is delivered on time and within budget. Robert Roberts General Contractor is a proud supporter of substance abuse recovery at CADIS. Let's dream big and take steps towards creating a community where everyone feels valued, supported, and empowered to reach their full potential. Support those on the path to recovery by donating to CADIS today.
I want to go to Mary Catherine in just a second, actually get her input on this, because she's been down this road as well. My question to you, though, and I can't wait to get to your career and how you dealt with it, because I can't imagine it. But which was the most difficult for you? This is just my personal intrigue, because I could not have quit alcohol on my own. I was able to quit opiates on my own. It was not pretty. I actually went and got a cabin in Gatlinburg by myself for a week and just plain white knuckled it, and was absolutely miserable, and ordered pizza. I couldn't even leave the cabin. It was miserable weather, which helped. I never want to go through that again. Which one was the most difficult for you?
Opiates for sure. I was one of those addicts that, you know, I replaced one substance with another. So, you know, I was able to sometimes get off the opiates for a second, but then I was drinking, I mean, you know, cheap as vodka, that kind of drinking, you know. But I was able, I always went back to the opiates. So I would say opiates for sure.
Well, I mean, let's talk about this. And Mary Catherine, please, I know this was something that you had an issue with as well. And I don't know that much about Mary Catherine. We're going to learn about each other quite a bit as we do these things. The feeling you get from an opiate, folks, there's no beating around the bush. It makes you feel good. The reason these things are addictive is because they work. It was a drug that worked so well, and it made you feel like everything was groovy when it was not, And who doesn't want to feel that way as you go back to it again and again? And it also worked in relieving pain. My experience was that when I was in pain, the opiate took the pain away, but I didn't really get a buzz. When I took it just for no reason, then I got that feeling very much like you said, you never injected it. Used to use heroin. I used to snort heroin, but I drew a line on breaking my flesh, piercing my flesh. Why there? I don't know. I didn't draw that many lines. Mary Catherine, your experience with them as well. Please get next to the mic.
Yeah, so about 12 years ago, when I found out that I had the BRCA gene genetic mutation for breast and ovarian cancer, I had some prophylactic surgeries, a double mastectomy, complete hysterectomy, and then reconstruction surgery all at once. So there were three different surgeons that worked together so that I could accomplish all three of those things in one surgery, and I was very grateful for. But at any rate, so along with that, three different doctors, three different pain pill prescriptions, believe it or not, how that happens, I really don't know, but it did. I stayed in the hospital for 3 days, and a friend of mine came to visit me, and I said, I just can't sleep, but I feel great. And she said, gosh, that really worries me about those pain pills, you know. And I thought, oh no, I've never had a problem with pain pills before. Long story short, I guess about a year later, I actually found a doctor that wrote Suboxone, and I went that route, and I was so grateful for it because I had tried many times to stop taking those pain pills, and I couldn't. It was very difficult. I was very sick, and I kept finding, I had a primary care physician at the time that was unfortunately willing to give me so many a month, and so I was able to continue that habit for so long. So I know what you're saying with the you know, how you appreciate the Suboxone and the medically assisted treatment.
I got a couple of things I want to follow up on very quickly, but let's stop right there, because I know that early on in recovery, I discovered that there was a whirlwind of terms and phrases and words that people used, and I didn't know what they were, and nobody was taking the time to slow down enough to tell me. I think I was actually in rehab down in Florida. I think I was 2.5 weeks in before I said, hey, can I ask, what is a sponsor? Because they kept talking about a sponsor, getting a sponsor. And to me, from the world of radio, I thought a sponsor was when you took a commercial break. It was somebody paying you to do what you did. I literally didn't know, and nobody ever took the time to say, oh, you idiot. A sponsor is who you basically ask to help you through on a personal level. Suboxone, you've both mentioned it. And for those out there who might be listening who don't know what that is, why is that word popping up so much? What is it to begin with?
So, you know, there are two different options. There's Vivitrol, that's medically assisted treatment, and Suboxone. Suboxone is predominantly used for opiates. Vivitrol predominantly used for alcohol withdrawal. Obviously, Katus, they do use both medications in their detox program. And I'm assuming that's where you...
I never took Suboxone at Katus. They did Vivitrol for me both times.
Perfect. So, you know, it's a way that someone that's addicted to opiates can obviously come off of them in a way that's not too damaging and hurtful.
Yeah, I think there was at some point some controversy about the drug. I think that controversy has been laid to rest. Again, it's a very effective pharmaceutical. I'm no great big fan of Purdue and Big Pharma out there, but, you know, they do come up with stuff that works, as I've already said. And Suboxone, for those out there, just to make it very simple, watch Dr. Stiles here break down the physiology and the microbiology of drugs. Essentially, you have little happiness receptors inside your blood, inside your brain, inside your body, and the drugs actually interact with those receptors, and it's kind of like a Lego locking piece. And the Suboxone interrupts that locking mechanism. It fills up the little holes so the little tabs can't get in there. And so it's kind of a replacement, and you don't have the longing the same way. Now, I want to make this point, too. This is not the type of stuff that your grandfather could have taken, where they gave him a shot of something, or he took a pill every day, and if he drank, he got violently ill and sick. So it's just a pure negative reaction. Don't go there. I don't want to vomit anymore. And abuse. This is something that actually works fairly gently to help you basically recoil from it and reverse your direction.
Sure. So also with Suboxone, so it has a blocker. And so if you if you do take an opiate while you're on Suboxone,
you don't get high.
You don't get high.
So it kind of becomes worthless.
Sure.
Now you're really wasting money.
That's right.
And I should say that in detox, they did give me Subutex, which is, if I'm right, it's essentially the same thing as Suboxone. So they told me that for fentanyl users, it has something to do with the half-life. It stays in your body for so long that I had to do Subutex. And I had also, the first time I came to detox, I had been trying the methadone clinic myself. So I had, I think, three different opiates in me. I had heroin, fentanyl, and methadone. And so they had to give me Subutex. I just wanted to say that.
Subutex sounds like a social media platform that's being released out there. Yeah. Maybe for recovery people. We'll steal it. Catus itself, and then we're going to get to your professional career here in a second. I just find this fascinating. Your experience with Catus, and again, they're sponsoring this thing. This is their podcast, so obviously we're going to be throwing them as much love as we can. I have never been. Catus has been that organization I've known about, I've referred other people to, I've talked to them, I've interviewed the people over there, and I'll say right now, and say this for the record, this podcast goes against the grain of a lot of old school old timers out there who truly believe that all anonymity has to be protected. You're never supposed to talk about this on radio or TV or newspapers. I long ago rejected that personally. Clearly, there's a new school of thought out there that we need to talk about this stuff in certain ways. So that's one of the reasons we're doing this today. But what was your, give me your brief bio on your experience with Catus. From walking in the door, take a couple of minutes until you walk back out.
So it was very intimidating. I got there, I packed a bag, and I was super intimidated, nervous, scared, I got there, everybody was kind. When I got into detox, I learned that we could watch Netflix and, at least your first couple of days, you could just rest and try to feel better. So that was a relief. I thought I was immediately going to be, thrown to the wolves or whatever. And, I should say that I didn't feel alone for the first time.
It is a bond building place.
Yeah.
You have people in your life that you associate with for various reasons. This is an actual link. It doesn't matter where these folks come from. You have something you share with them that is your addiction and the misery that's caused. And it's a very deep, abiding relationship that you make with some of these people in that tiny little room for those 5 days or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. Before I got there, I just felt totally alone. I felt like, I don't know why I felt this way, but I felt like I was the only one in the world suffering from this. It was terrible. But I got there, and pretty much everyone that worked there in some capacity was in recovery as well. Almost everyone that I met, and it was just nice to have these people that were, employees. They're doing my paperwork. But they're also telling me, like, dude, I get it. I've been there too, 2, 3, 4, 5, however many years ago, I was exactly where you are. And I was like, okay, so it can be done, and that was detox your very first step. I was immediately like, okay, at least I'm among people like me.
That's one of the big steps you have to take early on, is recognizing the fact that we talk about this in the program, in the rooms. These are all phrases that you hear more and more when you get into recovery. And it's just the community that you have, the greater community and the one nearest you. And one of the things you have to realize is that you're not unique. Every one of us go in thinking that we are terminally unique. Nobody else has lived this story. My story is crazy. And you realize that pretty much everything you've been through, somebody is there that has been through it and gotten through the other side. And that's where the hope starts to kick in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And mine felt somewhat tame compared to some of the stuff I'd heard and the people that had made it out to the other side. And I was just like, wow, if they can do it, I can probably do it. But after I got to detox, I went through, residential, and that was definitely different. It was, you're in a room with a couple more people than you were in detox and it's stuff. And you do a lot more, you're doing the meetings, you're kind of getting the groove of going to meetings and being open and sharing, cause I was very quiet initially. I didn't really want to talk. Obviously I felt bad, physically. But I got to residential, and it was a bigger group. You start getting that feel for what a room for what an AA or NA room on the outside is going to be like. So, and again, it was just being with people that are like me. It felt good.
Yeah. It's the equalization that goes on, the downsizing of your own ego, that uniqueness we talked about.
Yes.
The humbling, huge for me, because, you know, I had gotten to a point in my career, in my life, where most people knew my name. Most people knew my face. Most people knew what I was about and what I did, and they had strong opinions about me. And if I was out in a social setting, very often I was being paid to be there, or I had been invited for some purpose. And when I went to rehab, to have an entire huge group of people, of my peers, people who had gone through what I had been going through, to learn from, and they didn't give a damn about me any more than anybody else. I didn't stand out in that crowd. They didn't know anything about me. My name meant nothing. My face meant nothing. My career meant nothing. It was the most remarkably wonderful experience for me, because I realized I could shut up and fall into the background, kind of the opposite of you, and get quiet and listen and learn from people. I mean, literally, you'll learn your real place in the pecking order in a situation like that. And if you come in with no foreknowledge of what you stand for or who you work for, it's the humbling was very important for me.
Me too. Yeah, just the uniqueness. I've said it so many times that it was huge for me to not feel alone. I could talk to people. But it was an experience like none other, I guess. And I think that just taking that first step, packing your bag and getting there, is the most important.
Well, you, like me, and the fact that people say, well, you have to hit rock bottom, and you hear that all the time. You know, you're not really going to be serious about it until you hit rock bottom. There's another saying that says the elevator stops at all floors. And there are new people that come into the program all the time that have not gotten anywhere near where I was, and God bless them. I cheer them on. Somebody comes in, they're 24, they think their life is over. I said, good for you for figuring it out at 24. But I thought, literally, when questioned about this by the people that ran the place, when it came time for me to leave, they said, we're not sure you hit rock bottom. I said, dude, being here is rock bottom. Mm-hmm. Having to come into recovery, and I don't mean that as a negative. I mean, that is rock bottom. I've just had to completely admit my powerlessness. Did you feel the same way?
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, I was working all the time, right? And, you know, like I said, I was pretty much paying rent, buying drugs and booze. That was it. And it was getting to the point where I was spending rent money, you know. So I was... if I wouldn't have made it to Cadiz, I probably would have ended up homeless. I mean, that's just the truth. Yeah.
And the transition from detox into just the general population, and how that transfer and transmogrification took place for you. And you go through a lot of emotions. You go through a lot of stages of grieving and loss and anxiety and things of that nature. But, you know, you also start seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, I think, pretty quickly. At least I did.
Absolutely. Once that physical, you know, for us opiate people, once that physical withdrawal is kind of gone, you can start, you know, focusing a little bit more on what you need to work on, you know, mentally. For me, it was, you know, we talk in the rooms all the time about, or there's that saying that, you know, your substance use is a symptom of the real problem. And I wholeheartedly believe that. I mean, I was depressed, whether circumstantially or not. I was depressed, very, very depressed. I felt alone. Isolation is my worst enemy. So just being around everyone else, it helped.
Yeah. When you had to have a light bulb moment at some point early on, you said, you know what, this isn't the worst thing that's happened to me. This might be the best thing that's happened to me.
Oh, no, because I've been to jail a bunch, too.
Yeah.
I went to prison once. So I was not in jail. I was not in prison, and I was not on the street. And for that, I was grateful. You know, I was getting 3 square meals a day. Well, you get those in jail too, but it's way better at Cadiz. Just throw that out there.
Yeah, let's compare jail food to any other food. I think we'll probably be, you know, pro absolutely. That latter category every single time. Can I ask what was your actual the amount that of substances you were using? What was your intake during the course of a day?
So it's kind of hard to quantify it with fentanyl, because what I was using was the press pills, the ones that look like the Roxy 30s, the blue ones. And so one of the nurses in detox actually described it to me. It's like, imagine you're mixing a batch of cookies, chocolate chip cookies. Some of the cookies are going to have way more chips than the other ones. And that's what happens with these pressed pills is, you know, and it happened to me firsthand. Like I would say at that time, probably 10 to 15 pressed pills a day. But the thing was, I could smoke.
Roxy, which is Roxycontin. Is that what it is? Those are what on the street, $30, $60 a piece?
When I first started buying them, they were $40 a piece.
And you were doing 6 a day?
No, I was doing probably 10 to 15.
10 to 15 a day.
Oh, no, not to begin with, no.
Oh,
no.
Yeah, but they're toward the end.
Yes, towards the end. But they also started getting them a lot cheaper.
Yeah, I can see where your rent went.
Yeah, yeah, but it's just in the, that's another thing to consider, too, is how much cheaper it's gotten. Because when I first started buying them, they were $40 a piece for one press pill. And at the end, before I went back into Cadis in September of 22, I was getting them for $3 or $4 a piece, the same thing.
And it'd be a good time to point this out, too. I don't know if you guys saw the news that came out over the course of the weekend, the headline, that in the greater Chattanooga metro area, they stopped 2,500 overdose deaths last year alone because of the naloxone that's out there. You talk about a miracle drug, and these are people who had gone to where you were, only their friends were slapping them around and they were not coming to, and it took either the nasal spray or getting a tablet or a little sheet of that little acrylic-looking stuff on their tongue and reversed a fatal overdose. 2,500 in 1 year. That's the kind of problem we're talking about. Our sheriff just got back from the border. He went down there not necessarily because of immigration, illegal or otherwise, but it was fentanyl that was driving his need to go down there and find out more. Where is this stuff coming from? So you're fully aware, I guess, probably more so than me, just what a vicious problem this has become.
Yeah. It's just so, you just never know what you're going to get when it's being made down in Mexico or wherever. You know, they're making them in labs or bathtubs almost. You know, that's the thing. That's why fentanyl is becoming so much more prevalent than heroin, is because you don't have to grow crops of poppy. You can take a tiny little lab out in the jungle and make thousands and thousands and thousands of pills.
So one of the reasons it's getting dusted into everything, too, is because they have so much of it, they literally don't know what to do with it anymore.
Yeah.
If you're dreaming of spring gardening weather, visit the Barn Nursery for the best selection of plants to bring on the spring blooms. The Barn Nursery is the South's premier garden center and a proud supporter of alcohol and drug abuse recovery at Cadis. Discover the elegance and charm of generations past at Brody Jewelers. With a legacy of craftsmanship and quality, Brody Jewelers offers a curated collection of exquisite pieces that tell stories of love and legacy. From vintage heirlooms to modern masterpieces, each piece carries a rich history waiting to be cherished by you. Visit Brody Jewelers today and experience the magic of this family-owned, historical, fine jewelry store, where every piece is a work of art and every customer is family. Brody Jewelers is a proud supporter of Cadis.
Okay, I'm going to go back to Mary Catherine for a second. By the way, folks, just so you will remember, this is the new podcast sponsored by Cadis. My name is Jeff Stiles with a Y. And Mary Catherine Gentry is with me as well, and my guest, Stephen. And this is Scarred But Smarter, the new podcast, the inaugural debut episode of what we hope to be the world's most popular podcast in just a few short months. If you guys share it, you know, relentlessly with friends and people of like mind, then maybe we'll get there. Mary Catherine, you telling your story just a second ago, I meant to ask a question. And then you actually brought up something kind of during the quick break we took there for our wonderful sponsors and reminded me of something else. First of all, when you talked about, you know, you going in and getting the prescriptions from three different doctors, circa what year would that have been?
So 12 to 13 years ago.
Okay. So this was during the time when doctors were, I'm sorry, folks, sue me if you want to. They were literally being encouraged at that time to write as many prescriptions for this drug as they could possibly do. I mean, they had everything, every reason to write a prescription, and very few negatives, very few reasons not to write a prescription. They would get golf junkets from the pharmaceutical companies for hitting a certain amount. I mean, this was a real push, and so you fell right into the middle of that gears, that machine work there.
You know, I think I really did. I'm not blaming anyone other than myself for what happened to me, but you're exactly right, yes.
Well, see, when I quit taking pain pills, it would have been about 2016, I'm thinking. And at that point, doctors were not writing prescriptions right and left. And if you were wanting one and needing one, it was getting more and more difficult to get. So that worm has turned. So I think it's just worthy of note. And we were talking about the naloxone. And there's another word for that. Narcan. Narcan is, I guess, just the off the counter, which they haven't quite gotten there yet. But name for it. You said your mother was given a prescription for pain medication, and they actually filled, and she didn't even know what it was, a prescription for Narcan at the same time. First time I've heard that.
That's right. So she had some serious back pain, and her doctor prescribed her an opiate, I think hydrocodone maybe, and she picked her prescription up at the pharmacy, and when she got home, opened the bag to find the Narcan and her pain prescription. So she called the pharmacy. She was confused about what that was, and they explained it to her, and I even called the doctor's office because I was confused as well why they wrote that. And you know, apparently the state of Tennessee, along with many other states, they've passed a law that I don't know necessarily if it's required, but they offer it to patients. But apparently this doctor that she had gone to went a step further and went ahead and wrote the script for that as well.
Very quickly, take just a second here and just get a commercial in for this podcast, which is, you know, again, we're launching it today. This is the new one. How do people find it? What kind of platforms, things of that nature? And also for CADIS itself. I mean, if somebody's hearing this, they go, hey, this might be for me. Ask your doctor if it's right for you. Ask Dr. Stiles if it's right for you. And how do they get in touch with the good folks at CADIS?
Sure. So you can always go to CADIS.org to learn all about our programs, all of the services that CADIS offers. Also, if you are struggling with addiction or you have a loved one that is struggling with addiction, reach out. Know that there's support out there. And know that you're not alone and your loved one is not alone. You can call 423-756-7644. That's CADIS. And we are in Chattanooga. And always remember that CADIS is always there to offer you support and help throughout the entire experience in your recovery.
756-7644, area code 423. Stephen, you have an interesting career, an interesting job. You guys have seen the show Wicked Tuna. Deep sea fishing, going out on a boat with a bunch of smelly guys and smelly fish for days and weeks at a time. And you were actually doing this while early in recovery. I can't even imagine how that worked.
So I went for my first season in 2019, and I actually didn't start going out to sea on boats. I started at what they call a set net salmon camp. So it's basically we're fishing from the beach, you know, salmon are shallow water fish. Mm-hmm. So, and I wouldn't say that, well, let me preface this by saying I had been doing opiates a little before then, but like I said, I hadn't graduated to fentanyl yet. So I was able to pretty much wean myself off enough to get on a plane, go to Alaska where I knew I wouldn't be able to find anything so that I could work. But while I was there on that camp, I wouldn't say that it was a party environment because there was a lot of professional guys. I mean, good guys there.
Lifelong.
Yes.
Not journeymen coming through.
No. Guys that have been working at that very camp for 15 years. And they were good people. So let me not, you know, paint it like it was a party environment. But as long as you did your job and you were responsible and safe, they didn't really care what you did. And I drank heavily, heavily, very heavily.
I'm going to make a bet that you were not the only one, though.
No. But I was by far the worst. But so what happened in 2020 was my second season doing salmon. I decided that that's a short season. It's 6 to 8 weeks. You know, normally you're up there for about 2 months. So I decided that I wanted to stay in Alaska longer and do some real fishing, go out to sea, you know, really, really get a taste of what it's like. So I went on to social media. They post all the time looking for guys. I found an ad for they were needing a deckhand to do longline black cod and halibut fishing. So I responded, sent the guy a message, and I said that I would love to do that, blah, blah, blah. He pretty much the first thing he said back to me in a text was that this is a clean and dry boat. I'm like, okay, no problem. So I said that was no problem. Whatever, we set up to meet. We met in person in Anchorage, and we sat at a picnic table, and he looked like he was 67 years old, had been fishing for 44 years. Steely gaze, real fisherman.
Picture the old man in the sea.
Yeah, but just tough as nails. He had that gaze that just looks through you, you know, and he's looking me dead in the eyes, and he's like, again, this is a clean and dry boat.
He saw through you.
He said, can you do that? And I said, yes, sir, I can. No problem. So so I did. I'm trying to make this short and concise, but so he gave me the job. I got on the boat. We went down to Seward, Alaska. We went out on our first trip. Typically, we were gone for about a week. You know, we could hold 50,000 pounds of fish. As soon as that was full, we came. But when we were going 300-400 miles out into the Gulf of Alaska. But so we went on our first trip. We came back, and I did not drink. I didn't do anything. Didn't take any weed. You know, weed's legal there. I didn't even take any of that. We went out. We came back. He told us and the other guys, or me and the other guys, that he was going to go up to Anchorage, which is about a three-hour drive from Seward, and get supplies because that's where the nearest Costco is. So he said he was going to go up there and be gone for 2 or 3 days to get supplies. You know, we were welcome to stay on the boat or we'd get a hotel or whatever. I'm like, cool. So he leaves. First thing I do, I had, you know, cash in my pocket. I went to the bar and I got hammered. And when I came back to the boat, he was not gone. He was waiting on the boat. And I don't know if it was a setup or if he just decided not to go, but regardless, he caught me drunk. And long story short, he told me I could either go to AA with him. See, I didn't know that he was an AA guy. I just thought that maybe he didn't do those things. But he had been sober for 44 years. And he told me that I could either go to AA with him or I could get off his boat and go home. And so I went to my first AA meeting in Sitka, Alaska in 2020.
Well, thank goodness for people like him and the businesses that they run that set the boundaries up front and don't throw you for a loop. And for goodness sakes, thank God for the fact that the hand of AA and the work that was begun with Dr. Bob and Bill W., that it was there for you when you needed it. I mean, he didn't just give you the hook. See what I did there? He actually said, I can help you.
And I gotta put this in there too that I think that sort of illustrates our whole, you know, AA NA principle sort of is that, you know, instead of just kicking me to the curb and saying, you know, I'm done with you, he wanted to help, you know, because he had been there. I think he probably saw, you know, I was a hard worker, you know, I was doing my job, but it's, you know, I broke his rules.
And I've seen you come and go since then, so you've certainly done it completely sober, completely, you know, substance free, and there are certain things in life that it's just so impossible for abusers to imagine. A concert, a baseball game. You know, I don't know that I'd ever been to a baseball game since I played baseball in high school where I didn't have a beer in my hand up until the time I actually, after 2006 when I went into rehab. Everything is new. I mean, just intimacy. Everything is new. I had a buzz all the time. Mm-hmm. And so you're able to go out and do this job. How was that? I mean, you did it sober for the first time, but you were thinking about that drink when you got back, and clearly you went to it. You know, you followed, you heard that bell. What was it like the next go around? Was it particularly tough?
No. So what happened is after we went to that first meeting, this is kind of embarrassing to admit, but he pretty much, because he knew, you know, how it is that early on when you just got a few days under your belt, he pretty much told me, he's like, you're not leaving the boat. You know, because he figured that I would go pick up some mini bottles somewhere or just do something, you know. And I think that after that first meeting, I was on that boat for about another 4 months and did not have a drink, not a single one. Not when we were on land, not at sea, nothing. But when I got back home in 2020, I mean, as soon as I got down to Seattle, I was right back at it, drinking heavily, you know. But so...
In your life, what has been the most difficult separation between activity and usage? I just mentioned a few, you know, triggers for a lot of, hey, going to my hometown and just being with family. I hate to say it. I mean, I loved my family, but going to my hometown, which I didn't really abuse things anywhere near as much then. I was just a young person and teenager, early 20 somethings, you know, and my family, they all used stuff. And it just didn't strike me as being that big a deal. But when I went back sober and clean and straight, I realized it was an ordeal. It wasn't just a trigger. It was an Alamo filled with triggers. So, well, what about you?
For me, so I grew up close to the beach, you know, and beach and drinking go together.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was difficult. the first few times that I would go to the coast or whatever, and you know, it's just, it's like, man, it's hot out here. Cold beer would just be awesome right now. And this is going to sound stupid, but mowing grass.
No, that doesn't sound stupid. That doesn't sound stupid at all.
Man, it was
the earth people. That's another phrase we use for people who can drink successfully. Most of the earth people I know equate cutting grass with having a cold beer.
Absolutely. And you know, live music, I won't go off on this tangent, but my family owns piano stores, and we've been in business since 1980. So I grew up in a very musical environment, and I played bars for a long time. You know, it was my primary source of income for a while. So I pretty much quit doing that altogether, not going to shows, but playing music. So that was something that I felt like I could not do without being high. It was just, you know, you get in that mode, whatever, and it was just something I stopped going to live shows for a while too. I think so. I actually talked to Mary Catherine about this yesterday. So I went to see Billy Strings in Atlanta Saturday night.
You are one of several I know.
Man,
I am assuming that I've said this all my life. Three things in this life that you have to see live for you to understand why they're popular: hockey, NASCAR, and the Grateful Dead. And people who don't get the Dead, it's because they never saw them live. Everybody keeps telling me, Billy Strings. I look at his videos, I listen to his stuff, it's okay. But another friend of mine just got back from that show, and he goes, man, it's awesome. So clearly I've got to go see him live.
It was unreal. I've been to hundreds of concerts. It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen. But since I've been sober, the 12th of this month, March, will be 18 months. So a year and a half. In that year and a half, I've gone to four live concerts. And the first three were just kind of small, and it was just, but I guess probably the early ones, I definitely felt like, man, I should be drinking like all these other people, you know. But this far along, I mean, I was, like I said, telling Mary Catherine yesterday, it was almost like being able to observe, you know, from the other side. It was kind of, that was fun in itself. And I'm not saying we're making fun of anyone.
No,
it's just,
No. It's the drunken behavior of others when you're not drinking is so much more apparent and obnoxious. And that's we just got to be totally honest here. Somebody who's newly sober can really, those folks can really be asses sometimes. You know, they can be real judgmental, but it's hard not to be. That used to be me. Now I'm looking at them. I'm clear-eyed and clear-brained, and I'm looking at them going, golly, was I really that jerkish? Was that that D-bag over there that's making a total fool of himself? Yeah, dude, you were. Ask anybody.
That's one of the biggest weights off my chest in sobriety is that, like, I no longer have to worry about what I did last night, how stupid I acted, you know, it's just a huge relief. It really is.
I was going to point out, you actually counted up the concerts you'd been to pretty quickly here. Back in the day, I just actually got together with some friends from back in the old radio days last Friday night, and one of them was telling me about a concert we went to that I have no memory of whatsoever, none whatsoever. And guess who my first concert was? Straight. Widespread Panic.
Oh, wow.
It was, and guess what? It was still fun. Mm-hmm. We still were able to dance and get our boogie on, and it was great. I didn't know what to expect. Well, Stephen, another final question really I have for you is what made you come in today? I mean, I've known you again in and out of the programs and the rooms, our home meeting, I guess, that we share together. And I was a little bit surprised when your name popped up right off the bat. And there is that, let's face it, there's that group of folks out there that think what we're doing goes against their, you know, original rules. And some people are more, I would call them thumpers, book thumpers, like Bible thumpers. You know, they take it far more seriously than maybe I do. But what made you want to come in and tell your story and just share this time?
Well, I'm with you. I am a complete open book. The people at my job know it. My family, I will talk about it with absolutely anyone, tell them exactly what I did. I don't feel like I have anything to hide anymore. So when I was asked, I think I just was sort of in the right place at the right time, you know, and a lady I respect very much at Oasis, actually, you know, where you go after residential at CADA, she asked me to do it. And I just felt like that the people that, like I said earlier, are afraid to take that first step, you know, if they feel like they're alone, isolation was my biggest enemy, bar none. It exponentially got worse when I would isolate. So the people that feel like they're alone, the people who are scared to take the first step, I think they could benefit from hearing I guess, from someone like me that's just like them.
I told Mary Catherine when she first approached me about doing this, I said I felt like I had an obligation because I had been on the air as a talk radio host for, you know, over two decades telling everybody that I was a wild partier, even way beyond those years when most people did it. As a grown man, I was a responsible and mature. I had children. I didn't miss, you know, scout meetings. I didn't miss ball games, anything like that. But I was still completely flaunting the laws of God and man and kind of thumbing my nose at the idea that you had to normalize and grow up. And I wanted them to know that I didn't get away with it because I felt like I saw myself as a rock star. And the rules didn't apply to me. And it was important that they know that, by God, they did. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for the chickens to come home to roost. But, you know, they were roosting. And in 2006, I can promise you that. Well, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it tremendously.
Thank you, Jeff.
And what are you doing now? What are you up to right now? I know you seem like you have a lot of irons in the fire.
So I went to CADIS the first time in December, I got to Oasis. So I did the 28 days detox and residential, and then I got to Oasis, the halfway house. That's kind of your third step at CADIS. And you have to get a job pretty quick. You get back in the groove of paying rent and things like that. Mm-hmm. So Publix is one block away from CADIS. I'd heard it was a great company to work for as far as benefits and pay for what it is, you know. So I went there. I started there January 10th of 2022. So in January of this year was 2 years. So I'm still there, but I'm back in nursing school now. That's what I wanted to do as soon as I graduated high school, and I did, but I dropped out because, you know, partying. Yeah. So I'm back in that, and that pretty much takes up most of my time working school.
CADIS offers, of course, the detox, the inpatient services, intense outpatient services. As you said, the transition time, they have sober living and things of that nature. Mary Catherine, come on in and kind of help me close up. Again, just, you know, who do they call? Who do they talk to? What do they do for the people? And people who are listening who might actually be in that predicament, hopefully you're hearing this clearly, but it's mostly probably for the people around them who are observing it and saying, I think I have a solution, a possible solution for you.
Exactly. So the CADIS phone number is 423-756-7644. And, of course, our website is CADIS.org. And if you are struggling or you have a loved one that is struggling with alcohol or drug abuse, I encourage you to love them, support them, and let them know that they're not alone, because it's so key to success of recovery. And can I say one more thing?
Your podcast.
Family support. And and, you know, Stephen, you had mentioned being alone in isolation, and I think I struggled for so long because I was so ashamed, and I have the most precious family on the planet. And I was absolutely mortified to tell them that there was a problem. But when I did, they rallied around me and supported me, and it just meant all the difference in the world.
Sure, sure. I wanted to share something with you guys, and I believe that there are no such thing as coincidences in this life. I really do think we're connected. We're connected in an ethereal way that we cannot see and measure today. I have various friends that send me little meditations of the day, thoughts for the day for people in the program. And as we begin this podcast and the very first episode here of Scarred But Smarter, I don't think we have to explain that name to anybody out there. I think it makes perfect sense. This is a quote from Harriet Arrow. The fir tree has no choice about starting its life in the crack of a rock. What nourishment it finds is often meager, and above the ground appears a twisted trunk grown in irregular spurts, marred by dead and broken branches and bent far to one side by the battering winds. Yet at the top, twigs hold their green needles year after year, giving proof that misshapen, imperfect, scarred, the tree lives. I think that's a good way to close it today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Mary Catherine.
And thank you, Stephen.
It was a privilege.
Scarred But Smarter is presented by CADIS. Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Services, Chattanooga's only nonprofit addiction recovery center with a full continuum of care, offering the highest quality of treatment to those struggling with substance abuse disorder, regardless of their ability to pay. Go to CADIS.org to learn more about our recovery and aftercare programs or to make a donation, because every gift is much needed and greatly appreciated. Thank you for letting us be a part of your journey. Find us online at CADIS.org.
Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, your destination for luxury home products that elevate every room in your house. Whether you're renovating your dream bathroom, designing a gourmet kitchen, or illuminating your living space with style, Ferguson has everything you need to turn your vision into reality. Transform your home into a sanctuary of sophistication with Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, where luxury meets inspiration. Ferguson proudly supports CADIS.
If you or someone you know is struggling with alcohol or drug abuse, reach out, seek support. Recovery is within reach. You are not alone, and CADIS will support you or your loved one every step of the way. Please call CADIS today for an assessment, 423-756-7644.